Vanderjam.
By the way, is he still thin?
What?
Gratowski, is he still thin?
Oh, absolutely. So, this was about 5 years ago. Gratowski and I were walking along Fifth Avenue, and we're talking, you see. So he invited me to come and teach that summer in Poland. And, you know, teach a workshop to actors and directors or whatever. And I had told him that I didn't want to come because, well, really, I didn't have anything left to teach. I had nothing left to say, and I didn't know anything. I couldn't teach anything. Exercises meant nothing to me anymore. And working on scenes from plays seemed ridiculous. Like, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I just couldn't do it. So he said to me, well, why don't you tell me anything you would like to have if you did a workshop for me, no matter how outrageous, and maybe I can give it to you. So I said, kind of jokingly, though in retrospect it makes a great deal of sense, I said, if you give me 40 Jewish women who speak neither English nor French, either women who have been in theater for a long time and want to leave it but don't know why, or young women who love the theater but have never seen a theater that they could love. And if these women could play the trumpet or the harp, and if I could work in a forest, then I'd come. And we both laughed a lot, and like a week or two, you know, later, he calls me from Poland. He's like, well, you know, 40 Jewish women are a little hard to find. I do have 40 women, though, and they pretty much all fit the description. So he said, I have some interesting men, too, but you don't have to work with them. They're all people that have in common the fact that they're questioning the theater. They don't all play the trumpet or the harp, but they all play a musical instrument. None of them speak English. And he found me a forest, and the only inhabitants of the forest were some wild boar and a hermit. And that was the offer that I couldn't refuse.
Huh.
So I had to go.
Gosh.
Yeah, so I went to Poland, and I had this wonderful group of young men and women, and, you know, the forest that he found, it was magical. You know, it was magical, hollow. It was a huge forest. Like, the trees were so large, four or five people linking their arms couldn't get it around the trees. So we were camped out beside the ruins of this tiny little castle, and we would eat around this great stone slab that we used as a sort of table. And our schedule was that we would usually start work around sunset, and then we'd work until 6 or 7 in the morning. And then, because Poles love to sing and dance, we generally sing and dance till about 10 or 11 in the morning. Then we'd have food. So generally bread, jam, cheese, and tea, and then we'd all sleep from noon to sunset. And now, technically, the situation was a very interesting one. Because if you don't find yourself in a forest with a group of 40 people who don't speak your language, all your moorings are gone.
Right.
Yeah, so to do scenes or improvisations or exercises in this kind of forest is ridiculous. Because then the question is, if you're not a tourist and you can't be there as a tourist, if you can't be there in a certain sense as a maker of art or creator of art, what do you do?
Uh-huh.
What do you do, and what do you do that has any kind of meaning or importance?
Yes.
So, you see, this experience in Poland was the first of many experiences that I led. Or you can call them workshops by analogy with the old workshops that we used to teach, acting in New York. But these new workshops, they were very different, because the basis of these workshops is just to create some terrible hole that we could all drop into. And that's usually kind of frightening, because we don't know where we're going to be in the next moment.
What do you mean exactly?
Well, what we have to do is just sit there and wait for someone else to have an impulse to do something. Now, in a way, that's something like theatrical improvisation.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, if you were a director working on a play by Chekhov, you might have the actors playing the mother and the son and the uncle, and they all sit in a room and do a made-up scene that isn't in the play. you know, you could say to them, all right, let's say it's a rainy Sunday afternoon on Soren's estate and you're trapped in the drawing room together. And everybody's going to improvise, saying and doing whatever the characters should say and do in that circumstance.
Uh-huh.
Except that in these improvisations, in these workshops, the theme is oneself.
Right.
So if you follow the same law of improvisation, which is that you do whatever your impulse as the character tells you to do, in this case, you're the character. So you have no imaginary situation to hide behind, and you have no other person to hide behind. What you're doing, in fact, is asking the questions that Stanislavski said that actors need to ask themselves as characters. Who am I? Why am I here? Where do I come from? And where am I going? But instead of applying them to a role, you apply them to yourself. In other words, in these workshops, a group of people come together, and I would go on the assumption that something had brought us. But the theme or the plot was made up of who we all were together. And that the question then was how to bring to action this theme.
Yes.
Define the theme through action. And that having the action was created by an impulse. And by somebody having an impulse, in a way, it's going right back to childhood. Because simply, like, a group of children can enter a room or they're brought into a room without toys and they begin to play. Grown-ups were learning how to play again.
Yes, right. So you would all sit together somewhere, and you would play in some way, but what would you actually do?
Well, I mean, okay. I can give you a good example. You see, we were for a week in the city before we went to the forest. And, of course, Grotowski was there in the city, too. So one of the things I asked him was that I be kept as far away from him as possible. So that way, I couldn't be influenced by him in any way. Because his whole group was leading workshops. But I did hear that every night they did something called a beehive. And, I mean, I love the sound of beehive. A night or two before we were supposed to go out to the country, I grabbed him and I said, okay, this beehive thing, I kind of want to participate in one. Just, like, I felt it would be something interesting. And he said, well, certainly. And, in fact, why don't you, with your group, lead a beehive instead of participating in one? I got nervous, right? I said, well, but what is a beehive? And he said, a beehive is at 8 o'clock, 100 strangers come into a room. And I said, okay, yes. And he said, yes. And whatever happens is a beehive. So I said, yeah, but like you, what am I supposed to do? And he said, that's up to you. I said, well, I don't really want to do this, and can I just participate? He was like, no, you lead the beehive. I was terrified, man, because in a way I felt like I was on stage.
Right.
Because suddenly I felt I was going to be judged by the great pole, but I did it, and what I remember of it, well, it's a good example.
God. Tell me about it.
Okay. All right. So I have a tape of this song. I can play it for you someday. It's unbelievably beautiful. I mean, talk about, you know, what amateurs can create. Because one of the young women in the group knew a few fragments of one of the most beautiful songs of St. Francis. It is a song in which you thank God for your eyes, you thank God for your heart, you thank God for your friends and for your life, and because it repeats itself over and over again, and it became our theme song. And I got to play the thing someday because, you know, you can't just believe that a group of people who don't know how to sing could make something so beautiful. And it was because we were just in really great harmony. But I decided that when people arrived for the beehive, our group would already be there singing the song, so we'd simply sing it and sing it and sing it until something happened.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a very beautiful song, and one person wanted to bring her large teddy bear. because she felt a little afraid of the event and whatever. But this teddy bear was something that when she was a kid, she loved, and she wanted somebody to bring a sheet, and somebody else wanted to bring a bowl of water in case people got hot or thirsty. And somebody suggested we have candles and there'd be no artificial light, but candlelight.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing but this song, a teddy bear, water, a sheet, and some candles. Now, this was very similar to theater, because I remember before this thing even began, like feeling like an actor who's about to go on stage, but didn't really know the lines yet. And all the critics were going to be there, and you're terrified. And I remember watching people getting ready for the evening, but, you know, there's no makeup, there's no costumes, but it's still exactly the way people prepare for performance. Like, people started taking off jewelry and their watches and stowing them away and making sure it's all secure. And then slowly people arrive, and, you know, the way they would arrive at the theater in ones and twos and tens and fifteens and what have you. And we were just sitting and singing this beautiful song, and people started to sit with us and started to learn the song.
Uh-huh.
And even though nothing in what we did led them to do it, in other words, it could have gone in any other direction.
Okay.
You see, so after a while, they were, whatever it was, 100 and something people who were all singing this very beautiful song together. We sang it over and over again. So there's, of course, as with any improv or performance, an instinct for when it's going to get boring. So after a certain point, I think it may have taken an hour or so, or hour and a half, but I grabbed the bear and I threw it in the air. And at that point, like 140 or 30 or whatever people suddenly just exploded. You know, it was like a Jackson Pollock, or suddenly like human beings exploding out from this tight little circle, and we were singing the song, and before you know it, there's two circles now dancing, and one's going clockwise and the other counterclockwise, and rhythm's mostly from the waist down. So like American Indian dance, it was just that thumping, persistent rhythm.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, you can see where the line between this or religious ceremony or like primitive tribal ritual or even something like the Nuremberg rallies, you know, it's a very thin line, because all these things depend on repetition, because we're talking in a sense about a group trance, and for any kind of trance, rhythm is essential.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, there's these two big circles going in different directions around each other with the thumping, and in the center of it, well, now Grotowski, he came to be a participant in this thing, and I don't know how it happened, because it happened spontaneously,
yes.
But it was fast. And in the center of the thing, there was Grotowski, and I was sitting opposite, and we just kept throwing this teddy bear back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And on one level, you could say this is childish. So I gave the teddy bear back, and suddenly at my chest, while the boom, 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 like the chanting was going on, I threw this teddy bear to him, and he gave it, like, he started sucking on its chest, and the bear went up in the air, and then there was an explosion, like, into something else. You know, what was it like? Like, it's like a kaleidoscope. It's like a human kaleidoscope.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the evening was like the shiftings of a kaleidoscope, because the only things I remember other than, you know, trying to control the thing was always being involved with movement, rhythm, repetition, song,
right,
chanting,
right,
or because two people in the group brought instruments, there was a flute and drums, which, you know, they're sacred instruments. It's sometimes the room would break up into six or seven different things going on at once, and like six or seven different improvs, and all of which they seem to be in some way related to each other. Like, it's like a magnificent cobweb. At one point, and this part was very interesting, I noticed that Grotowski was in the center of one group, held around a bunch of candles that they got together, and like childlike, they're just staring at the fire because in that moment the room was really quiet, and there was a group chanting in the one corner and a group doing something else in the other corner. And like, I felt in that moment I could go with my own impulse. And like, just follow my impulse instead of trying to be aware of the whole thing. And I saw that Grotowski, he had his hand right in the flame and he was holding it there. And I approached him and wondered if I could do it. So I put my left hand in the flame and I could hold it there as long as I liked. And there was no burn, no pain. But when I put my right hand over it, I couldn't hold it there for a second. So Grotowski says, if it burns, change some little thing in yourself. And like, I tried to do that, but it didn't work. Because I remember a very, very beautiful procession with the sheet and with somehow being somebody being carried below it. And the sheet was like this canopy. And with the entire groups weaving around the room, they're all chanting. I remember there's a moment where people are dancing and I'm dancing with a girl, and suddenly our hands are vibrating right near each other, like this, vibrating, vibrating. Then we got on our knees, and suddenly I'm sobbing in her arms, and she's sort of cradling me, and then she started to cry. We just hugged each other for a moment and started dancing again. Like, and then at a certain point, a couple hours later, we went back singing the St. Francis song, and I think I lost my nerve there because I probably should have gone longer. But on the other hand, my point of view, it's very different from the Poles, because they're like Marines. They would have gone on all night. Like, my impulse is that if the show has been good, get out and leave them laughing. So I think that this thing lasted like 4 or 5 hours instead of maybe 8 or 10. So after we've been singing the song another 15 or 20 minutes or whatever, I got two of the people in my group and we went to the door and I waved to people that they could leave, that it's over. And saying goodbye took 2 hours because nobody left until they had the true impulse to leave. Because we're talking about trying to find the true impulse, not to do what you should do or ought to do or what's expected of you. Trying to find that, what is it that you really want to do or need to do or have to do? So the singing went on, and the people left as they wanted to leave. And what was really kind of amazing was that each person said farewell to the three of us, and especially to me, but in no single case was the farewell the same. So, like, one person would just shake me by the hand and walk out, and another person might, like, I still have a beautiful cross that somebody took from around their neck. Total stranger, never saw again. I can't remember who it even was, and they put it around my neck. One person jumped on my back and rode me around the room like a horse, and like, people sang. And when it was over, it was like the theater after a performance because everyone put on their earrings and their watches and they went off to the rail station to drink a lot and have a good dinner. And there was one girl who wasn't in the group, who just wouldn't leave, so we took her along with us.
Incredible. God, well, tell me about some of the other work that you did with your group.
Well, I mean, it's hard to describe what went on in Poland, I remember once we were still in the city, the people in the group, they got me to understand the idea that they really wanted me to do something with them that was like the sort of work we used to do in New York. So we did this kind of ordinary, banal improv where everybody was supposed to be on a plane, and they just learned the pilot that he comes out and says there's something wrong with the motor. But what's unusual about this improv is that two of the people in it fell in love And since then, they've actually gotten married. So when we went, like, out of the fear of being on the plane, they fell in love, thinking that they were going to die at any moment. And so when we went to the forest, these two disappeared because they understood the experiment so well that they realized that to go off with each other in the forest, it was so much more important than doing any kind of experiment that the group was doing as a group. So, like halfway through the week, we stumble on this clearing, and the two of them, they're asleep in each other's arms. Like, it's around dawn. So we just put flowers around them so they know that someone had been there, and we just went away. So on the last day we were staying in the forest, they showed up. They shook our hands and thanked me for the wonderful work that they had been able to do. So they understood what it was about. Like, that poses the question of what was it about? And it was something to do with living. Like, on the final day in the forest, the whole group did something so wonderful, a hollow. They arranged like this christening, like a baptism for me, and they filled up the castle with flowers. And it was just this miracle of light because they set up hundreds of candles and torches. Like, no church could have looked more beautiful. And it was a simple ceremony. One of them played the role of my godfather, and another one of them played the role of my godmother, and I was given a new name. They called me Yendrush. And some of them took it completely seriously, and some of them found it funny. But I really felt like I had a new name. That then we had this enormous feast and had blueberries from the fields and chocolate someone like walked forever to buy and raspberry soup and rabbit stew, and we sang Polish songs and Greek songs and every other kind of song, and everybody danced for the rest of the night. You see, let me pull it up here. You got that photo?
Yeah, I see
That,
it.
okay, that's me in the forest, and that really is what I felt like. See, that's the state that I was in.
God. Who's this girl?
Oh, that was a young woman. She was nicknamed with an Indian name.
I wonder why.
Yeah, because she's Polish, and now apparently she works in a Russian restaurant in London.
Well, Howard, gosh. Yeah, I remember George telling me that he'd met with you right around then, and he said you'd looked like you'd come back from a war or something.
Yeah, I remember meeting him. He asked me a lot of friendly questions. I think I called you up that summer, right?
Well, I think I was out of town.
Well, I mean, most people that I met then, they thought there was something wrong with me. I mean, they didn't say that, but you can tell when that's what they're thinking. But what I think I experienced was for the first time in my life to know what it means to truly be alive. And that's very frightening because with that comes an immediate awareness of death because they really go hand in hand. Like the kind of impulse that leads to Walt Whitman, like Leaves of Grass, that feeling of being connected with everything also means being connected with death. And that's pretty scary. But I felt as if I were floating above the ground, not walking. Like, I could do things like go out to the highway and watch the lights go from red to green and think, wonderful. It was a feeling of recognizing everything, of being able to be aware of the reality and the specialness of even the most ordinary things. And that feeling lasted for quite a while. And gradually, it faded. And one day in early fall, I was out in the country walking through a field, and suddenly I hear a voice say, "Little Prince." And So The Little Prince was a book I had always thought of, just pablum. But still, I thought if a voice comes to me in a field, and this was the first voice I had ever heard, maybe I should go and read the book. So now that same morning, I had gotten a letter from one of the women who had been in the group in Poland, and she said, "You have dominated me." She spoke very awkward English, and she had gone to the dictionary and crossed out the word dominate and written, "No, the correct word is tame." So when I went into town and bought the book and started to read it, I saw that taming was the most important word in the whole book. And by the end of the book, I'm in tears because I'm moved by the story. I went to try to write an answer to the letter because it was a long letter, and I just couldn't find the right words, I guess. So finally, I take my hand and I put it on the paper and I outline it with a pen and put in the center something like, "Your heart is in my hand," or something like that. And then I go over to my cousin's house and I went swimming because he lived in the country and had a pool and wasn't there. So I went into his library. He bought at an auction the collected issues of Minotaur, the old magazine. And it was this great surrealist magazine in the 20s and 30s, and it had all kinds of people like Dali and so on. And I've never considered myself a surrealist, but I had never seen a copy of it. And here they were, bound by year. So I just pick one out, I open it, and there's a full page of the letter A from John Tenniel's Alice in Wonderland. And I think, well, it's been a day of coincidences, but not unusual that surrealists would have been interested in Alice. And I had done that play on Alice. So I open the next page and there's four handprints. And one was Andre Breton, another was Andre Durain, the third was Andre, I've gotten it down somewhere, not Malraux, it's another surrealist, all A's, and the fourth was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince. So they had given their handprints to some kind of expert without saying whose hands they belonged to. And under Exupéry, he was an artist with powerful eyes who apparently was the tamer of wild animals. So you think this is incredible, right? I look back and I see when this came on, and it came out on May 12th, 1934. And my mother was born on May 11th, 1934.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that's what started me off with Saint-Exupéry and the little. So today, I think there's a very, almost fascist thing in The Little Prince. There's a kind of totalitarian sentimentality in there. Like that love, that masculine love of a certain kind of muscle. You know what I mean? I can't quite put my finger on it. I can see a beautiful SS man loving the little prince. And I don't know why, but there does seem to be something wrong with that. It kind of stinks.
Hey, didn't George once tell me that you were going to do a play based on The Little Prince?
Yeah, well, what happened was the same fall that I was back in New York, I met this Japanese Buddhist. He was a priest named Kozan. And, I thought he was Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream. He has this beautiful, delicate little smile. And I thought he was the little prince. So naturally, I went to go to the Sahara to work on The Little Prince with two actors and this Japanese priest.
You did?
Well, yeah, because, all right, looking back, I was still in a pretty peculiar state at the time, but I look into the rearview mirror of my car, and I would see little birds flying out of my mouth. And, like, I remember being exhausted during that period. Like, I always felt weak, and, like, I didn't really know what was going on with me. But, like, I would just sit out alone in the country for days and not really do anything except, like, write a little bit in my diary. And, you know, I was always thinking about death.
But you went to the Sahara.
Yeah, so we went off into the desert, and, you know, we're riding through on camels, and we rode and we rode, and then at night we would walk out, and, you know, the sky's enormous, and we would just look out at the stars, and I would keep thinking about the same things I was thinking about at home, especially Kita. I mean, I thought about nothing but marriage. And I remember one very dark night being at an oasis, and there were these palm trees moving in the wind, and I hear Kazan singing somewhere far away with his bass and following his voice along the sand. And, you know, I thought he had something to teach me, man. Like, sometimes I would meditate with him, and sometimes I would go off and meditate by myself, and I'd see images of her. You know, once I saw her growing old and her hair turning gray, like, in front of my eyes, and I would just wail and yell my lungs out there in the sand. The desert, it's pretty horrible. It's very cold. And we were searching for something, but we couldn't actually tell if we were finding anything. So once Kazan and I were sitting out on the dunes, and we just ate sand. Like, we weren't trying to be funny or anything. Like, I started and he started, and we just ate sand and threw up. And, like, that was how desperate we were. We didn't even know why we were there. We didn't know what we were looking for. And the whole thing seemed completely absurd and empty. And, like this was the last chance at something.
So what happened then?
Well, in those days, I was still going completely on impulse. So on impulse, I brought Kazan back to stay with us in New York when we got back from the desert, and he stayed for 6 months. He actually took over the whole family in a way.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, there was a center missing in the house at the time. I mean, there certainly wasn't a father, because I was always thinking about going off and going to Asia or doing God knows what. And he taught the whole family to meditate. He told them all about Asia and the East and his monastery and everything. And he really captivated everybody. He had this whole bag of tricks. You know, he could do anything. There was nothing that he couldn't do. You know, if he wanted to. You know, the Christmas tree, we didn't have decorations, so he just made them out of nowhere. Like, he literally developed himself so that he could push on his fingers and rise off out of a chair. Like, he could literally go like this. Go up on two fingers, like, go into almost like a headstand and hold himself up with two fingers. And he would constantly just be doing these things, and he knew about everything. Like, he was actually a great doctor. And because, like, if you were tense, like, she would sometimes get a little tension in her neck, and he would immediately have her on the floor, and he'd be walking up and down on her back and doing unbelievable massages. And, you know, the kids found him amazing. Like, Nick would do a chin-up, and then Kazan would do 1,000, and he had a great way with kids. You know, we would visit friends who had children, and he would just be playing with them in a way that, like, we just can't do. Like, the kids, they're just laughing and laughing and laughing, you know, about what this Japanese monk is doing in his robes. And he was an acrobat and a magician and a ventriloquist, like, everything. Like, the amazing thing is, I don't think he had any interest in children whatsoever. Like, none. I don't think he even liked them. But when he lived with us, like in the first week, the kids were just googly-eyed. And then, her and I, we'd go out a couple weeks later, and, Marina would have a fever of 104, the flu, and he wouldn't even go in and say hello to her.
Oh.
So around Christmas, we're out in the country a lot. I used to go and walk for hours on the golf courses out there, but, this time around, it's snowing, so the course is covered in snow, and I'm feeling just lost, like lost and angry and confused. And he was taking over probably more and more and telling us what to have for dinner, and his own habits have changed. And like, started wearing Gucci leather shoes under his robes and eating huge amounts of food. I mean, he ate twice as much as the kids. This tiny little Buddhist man who, first meet him, he's eating a little bowl of milk and hot milk and rice, and now eating beef. And like, it's just strange. We tried to work together, but like, our work consisted of trying to learn to do these very painful prostrations that they do in the monastery, but we hadn't really been working very much. And anyway, we're all out in the country. We went to Christmas Mass together, and he was all dressed up in his Buddhist finery. And, one of those Catholic churches in Long Island where the priest talks about communism, birth control. And like, I'm sitting there in Mass. I'm wondering, well, what in the world is going on here? Because here I am, a grown man, and there's this strange person living in my house. I'm not working. All I'm doing is scribbling poetry in my diary, and can't get a job teaching anymore, so I don't know what to do. And all of a sudden, this huge creature appeared looking at the congregation. It was like 6'8", something like that. It was half bull and half man, and its skin is blue. It had violets growing out of its eyelids. It had poppies growing in its toenails, and it stood there for the whole mass, and like nothing I could do would make it disappear. Because I thought, well, I'm seeing this because I'm bored. So, if I close my, like, I couldn't make this creature go away.
Incredible.
So now, obviously, I didn't talk with people about it because they think it was weird, and I felt like this thing had come to me somehow to comfort me. Like, he was appearing to say, well, you may feel low and you may not be able to create art right now, but look at what can come to you on Christmas Eve. Hang in there, old friend. I may seem weird to you, but on these weird voyages, weird things show up. It's part of the journey. You're okay. Hang in there.
God, incredible. Hey, by the way, did you ever see that play, The Violets Are in Blue?
No.
Oh, well, when you mentioned the violets, it reminded me of that. It was about people being strangled on a submarine. Well, so that was Christmas. What happened after that?
Like, do you really want to hear about all of this?
Yes.
Okay, well, after that, I began to think about going to India, and Kazan suddenly just left one day, and a lot of weird things started happening. So I was experiencing a lot of synchronicity.
A lot of synchronicity.
So as I understand it, I think it's possible that certain periods of your life, your unconscious can have an enormous amount of power, so that it can actually manifest what you need at the time. It can simply give you signs, make people appear, give you the feeling that there are so many coincidences that you have to be on the right path. Like, you could be on the wrong path, but I got very hot just before I went to India, and I was in a very strange state, and I was nervous about going. Maybe I was at my most desperate then, but a lot of very strange things did start happening. So, okay, so I had I had got this feeling, which I thought it was appealing to me at the time, which was that I would have a flag, like a very large flag. And wherever I worked, this flag would fly. Or if we're outside, like with a group, like the flag would be the thing we lay on at night, that somehow between laying on this flag and working with the flag flying over us, the flag would, it would pick up vibrations of a kind and would somehow, it would become something that I could bring back from the journey. Okay. And like, that I not only needed it as a talisman, that I needed to somehow bring it back. It's like one day around this period, I'm talking to this woman I know about the 1960s. So to illustrate, I got one of the books off my shelf, a book of photographs from the 60s that like I hadn't looked at in 10 years. And the woman says, "My God, you know, that's one of my best friends who took this picture. He's now a flag maker." And you know, that's pretty incredible. So naturally, I go to meet the flag maker, and he's a straightforward looking guy, sweet, you know, healthy looking, big blonde guy. He had this beautiful loft down in the village with these happy flags, and I was all about the little prince, and I talked to him about the little prince and the adventures and everything like that, and how I needed the flag and what the flag should be. And he seemed to really connect with it. So he kept saying, "I understand. Come back in a couple weeks. I'll have a design for you." So I come back. He showed me a design. I think it's very odd because like I expected something gentle and lyrical, and there's something about this that was so powerful. It was almost overwhelming because it did include the Tibetan swastika.
He put a swastika on your flag?
Okay, so I know, but it was the Tibetan swastika, not the Nazi swastika. So not the same. It is one of the most ancient Tibetan symbols. There was the purple of the church, and just strange but intriguing. And I said, "It's not what I expected, but it's powerful. Can you show me the material that you put into it?" And he says, "Sure," and takes me to another part of the loft. And oh man, so hollow. In this loft, there are flags on the wall and two tables. And on one table's the design, and on the other's the material. So we go and look at the material, and he shows me how the colors go and against each other, and say, "Can I see the design?" And he says, "Sure." We go back to the table, and the design's gone. We never found it. We searched the entire loft, top to bottom, and we never found the design. It just disappeared.
Gosh.
So my idea with the flag was before I left for India, I wanted some people who are close to me to have the flag in their room for the night to sleep with. So in the morning, then they would sew something into the flag. So she threw this big party for me and before I'm leaving, and I pick up the flag and I took it into Marina because I thought she could sleep with it. And I say, "Well, what do you think of this?" And she says, "What is that? It's awful." And I said, "It's a flag." And she says, "I don't like it." So I say, "Well, I really want you to spend the night with it, you know." And she really thought that the flag was awful. So I put it back in the bedroom. And the apartment was filled with guests at that point. And at one point she says, "Okay, the flag. Where's the flag?" I said, "Oh yeah, the flag." So I go and get the flag, and I open the flag out. She goes absolutely white and runs out of the room and vomits. And the party just comes to a halt. It all breaks up, and I tell a very good friend of mine, like, I didn't tell her anything about this. And I said, about this flag, what I'd like you to do is spend the night with it. And she says, "What a lovely idea." So the next morning, she calls me up and says, "I couldn't put anything on the flag. It's such a horrible night, terrible dreams, devils, you know, like Bosch-like things. I was just in such a strange mood, I couldn't do anything." So then I give it to a young woman who was in the Polish group, who was now in New York, and I don't tell her anything about anything like this. About 6 o'clock in the morning, she calls me up and says, I've got to come and see you right away. And I think, oh, God. So she comes up and says, I saw things. I saw things around the flag. I know you're stubborn. I know you want to take thing with you. But if you follow advice, you put hole in the ground and burn it. Cover it with earth because the devil's in it. So I never took the flag with me, and I gave it to her. She had a ceremony some 6 months later in France with some friends, and they burned it.
That's really amazing. So, did you ever go to India?
Yeah, I went to India that spring, and I came back just feeling all wrong. Like, I had been to India, and I just felt like a tourist. I found nothing. I was spending the summer on Long Island with the fam, and I heard about this group in Scotland called Findhorn, where people sang and talked and meditated with plants. Okay. And it was founded by some very middle-class English and Scottish eccentrics. Like, some of them were intellectuals, some of them were not. And I heard that they grew things in the soil that supposedly almost nothing could grow in because it's almost beach soil. And they had built, not built, but grown, like the largest cauliflower in the world. And these sort of, these cabbages that, and like they've grown trees that apparently you can't grow in the British Isles. So I go there and it's an amazing place. Like if there's insects bothering the plants, they'll talk to the insects, you know, make an agreement where they set aside a patch of vegetables just for the insects. And the insects leave the main part alone. Like things like that. So they live with this sort of wild enthusiasm. Because, like, enthusiasm refers to the God within. And they seem to see the God within everything. Like, all sorts of things that we would do mechanically because we feel they have to be done. They do it with such an extraordinary intensity. Like, all the buildings at Findhorn just shine. And then things like the icebox, the stove, the car, like, they all have names. And since, like, you wouldn't treat Helen, the icebox, with any respect, and Margaret, your wife, you would make sure that Helen is as clean as Margaret, or, you know, is treated with the same respect, so that I see you, you know. I saw on a day where the place was just filled with activity, the leaders of this community, this wonderful middle-class English couple, Peter and Eileen, and they'd stop and, you know, as the heads or inspiration of this thing, they would do nothing but clean their car for like 5 or 6 hours. And the car would look almost supernatural. Like, it glows. The whole place glows for that reason. And it seems to have an almost magical aspect. In a sense, it is magic. They've discovered a new kind of magic. And when I was there, like, I remember being in the woods and, like, I would look at a leaf and I would see that the thing was alive in the leaf. And then I just remember running through the woods as fast as I could with this incredible laugh coming out of me. Just really being in that state where like laughter and tears seem to merge. And it just blasted me right open. Like when I came out of the Findhorn, I was hallucinating nonstop. Like I was seeing clouds as creatures, and like the people on airplanes all had animals' faces. Like I was on a trip. It was like being in a William Blake world suddenly. Like things were exploding. I went to Belgrade because I wanted to talk to Grotowski. So him and I got together at midnight in my hotel room and we drank instant coffee out of the top of my shaving cream. And we just talked from midnight till 11 the next morning, slept 3 hours and had some lunch and talked from 3 in the afternoon. Like I talked, he didn't say a word. 3 in the afternoon till about 9 the next morning. And then I caught the 11 o'clock plane out of Yugoslavia and then came home.
Wow.
So, whew, let's see. After that, I did a workshop here in New York. I did a few. Things were they were ending. I guess the last really big event took place in the fall, and that was out at Montauk. And there were just maybe nine of us involved, mostly men. We borrowed Dick Avedon's property out on Montauk in the country. It's like Heathcliff country, right? Absolutely wild, you know. In the summer, even, it's still rugged, and there's nothing on the property, just small bush forest and high cliffs. And what we wanted to do on All Souls Eve, Halloween, is use it as a point of departure for something. Like, the idea was that each of us would prepare something for the others in the spirit of Halloween. And we built ourselves a shack that we lived in, and it was getting very cold out there because November, late October. The thing that I prepared was like, hadn't had it for a while, but I have a very unpleasant dream about my grandfather on my mother's side, where he's alive in a hotel room on the west side, and we haven't either known it or admitted it, and haven't visited him in all these years. And I visit him, and it's horrible because I feel so guilty. And so, since one of the ceremonies of All Souls Eve is to welcome the dead, to bring the spirits of the dead that you love and welcome them as you go into the dead of winter, I did something to try to bring my grandfather to peace. So the others participated, but the big event was three people kept disappearing in the middle of the night every night. Well, we knew that they were preparing something big, but we didn't know what. So at midnight on Halloween, dark moon above these cliffs, we're all told to gather at the uppermost part, and then we'd be taken somewhere. So we did, and it was cold, and we waited, and then the three of them, so Helen, Bill, and Frank showed up wearing white. Like, they made sheets that looked a little spooky rather than funny. And they took us to the basement of this house that had burned down on the property. In the basement, they got this table with benches they had made. And, like, they put out paper and pencils and wine and glasses. And we're asked to sit there, make out our last will and testament, to think about and write about what our last words to the world or somebody we were close to. And you know, that's quite the task. We must have been down there for maybe an hour and a half, maybe two, and one at a time they'd ask one of us to come with them. Suddenly, like, one of the people in white would appear and motion for one of us to come. So there's less and less people sitting at the table. And you know, the longer you stay, the harder it is just thinking. But they gave everybody time to really have to come to terms with it. And I was one of the last. They came for me and they put a blindfold on me, which is what they did. And they did the same thing with everybody else. And they ran me through the fields, two people. And they had found what was like this potting shed, this old shed on the ground. It's a tiny room. Once had tools in it, and they took me down these stairs, and the room was filled with white light. And they told me to undress and give them all my stuff, and then they put me on a table and they sponge me down, and I start flashing on death camps and secret police, and I don't know what happened to the other people, so I start crying uncontrollably, and they stand me on my feet and they take pictures of me naked, and then I'm naked, I'm blindfolded again, and they run me through these forests again and just thrown down into this tent made of sheets, and the sheets on the ground, and there are just all these naked bodies huddling together for warmth in the cold, and we're just left there for like an hour. And then one by one at a time, we're led out. And the blindfold, it's put on again. And I feel myself being lowered onto like a stretcher. And the stretcher is carried a long way, very slowly through the woods. And then I feel myself being lowered into the ground because they had, in fact, dug six graves, 8 feet deep. And I felt pieces of wood being put on me. Like, I can't tell you, Hollow, what I was going through. I was lowered into the grave on a stretcher, and then this wood is put over me. My stuff is put like in my hands, and they stretch a sheet or like canvas about this much over my head, and then they start shoveling dirt onto the grave. And I really have the feeling of being buried alive. And after being in the grave for almost half an hour, like, I didn't know how long I had been there, but I was resurrected, lifted out of the grave, blindfold taken off, run back through the field, and then we came to this circle of fire with good music and hot wine, and we danced until dawn, and then we filled up the graves to the best of our ability, and then we just went back to New York.
Wow. God.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that was really the last big event. Like, that was the end. And I mean, except for that, you know, began to realize that I didn't want to do these things anymore. Like, I felt sort of becalmed. Like, you know the chapter in Moby Dick where the wind just goes out of the sails? And, like, another strange thing is, like, I couldn't imagine another event that would be... I don't know. I just had the feeling that from now on, I would always be able to see the outcome of these things. Like, they wouldn't have that same terrifying, exhilarating feeling of dropping into a black hole or whatever that was. Like, they would become predictable. Like, repertory theater or something, you know? And I remember around this time going to this very strange magic island that's connected to Finnhorn, where apparently Macbeth is buried, and supposedly, like, the last battle of Atlantis is still being fought invisibly. And there's, like, caves on the beach, inhabited by hermits and wanderers, and they're meditating and looking out at the sea. And I went to a church on the island to pray, because I was very confused, and in the middle of... Like, in the I just walked in and started to pray, and then I got revolted. Like, I thought, I can't pray anymore. This is revolting. No more prayer, no more magic. I just got to get out of this place. And then last winter, without thinking about it very much, I went to see an agent I knew to tell him I was interested in directing again. And actually, he kind of seemed surprised to see that Rip Van Winkle was still alive. And it was strange. He sent me down to this theater to see a play, see if I found the author interesting, you know. And it was a funny feeling suddenly sitting in the audience with her, looking at the play and trying to make up my mind about it. Like, suddenly feeling like an old hand, an old pro doing something professional. I sat backstage with a couple of the actors after, and someone introduced me to some of the ones that I hadn't met before, and they had heard about my work from the past, and, you know, thought I was all very cozy, and there was something nice about that.
Right.
So, honestly, I'm kind of repelled by the whole story, if you want to know.
What?
I mean... Like, who did I think I was? You know, like, that's a story of, like, a spoiled princess. You know, who did I think I was? The Shah? I mean, I wonder if people, such as myself, are not really more like Albert Speer. You know who that is, Albert Speer?
No.
Well, because I've been thinking a lot about him. Because I think in some ways I am Speer. And it's time for me to be caught and tried the same way that he was.
What are you talking about?
Okay, just hear me out. See, he was a very cultivated man. He was an architect, an artist. He thought that the ordinary rules of life and living didn't apply to him. And I would like to be stripped and unmasked. I feel like I deserve it because I feel like everything I've done... It's just horrific. Like, just horrific.
But why?
Well, because I've seen a lot of death these last few years. And there's one thing that's for sure about death. You can do it alone. And that seems quite certain. Because, you know, I've seen... Like, the people around your bed mean nothing. Your reviews, they mean nothing. Whatever it is, you do it alone. And the question is, when I'm on my deathbed, what kind of person am I going to be? And I'm dubious about the kind of person who would have lived the last few years the same way that I did.
But why should you feel that way?
Well, I had a rough time these last few months, man. Three different people in my family were in the hospital at the same time, and then my mom got sick, and then she had something wrong with her back, and then we were all worried about her. She's going to be all right, thank God, but I'm feeling raw right now, you know? I can't sleep. My nerves are shot. I feel like my face is being shoved in the mud. Like, I'm affected by everything. Like, so last week, I have this really nice director, Norwegian. He's over for dinner. Known him for a few years. He's somebody I think I'm very fond of. But, like, I was just sitting there thinking, like, he's a pompous, defensive, conservative stuff shirt, and he's only interested in theater, and he's just talking and talking. And his mom was this famous Norwegian comedian, and I realize he has said, "I remember my mother," at least 400 times during the evening, and he's telling story after story about his mother, you know, and they're stories I have heard 20 times before. He's drinking a whole bottle of bourbon very quietly, and his laugh is just so horrible. Like, I could hear his laugh, like the pain that's in it, just the hollowness of what being that woman's son has done to him. So on a certain point, I just had to ask him to leave, you know, nicely. But I told him I had to get up early the next morning because it was horrible. It was just like as if he had died in my living room, and I went to the bathroom and cried because I had lost a friend. And then after he had gone, I turned the TV on, and there was this guy who just won the some kind of sports event, and he had this great big check, and some got a huge silver bottle, and he couldn't stuff the check into the bottle, and put the ball in front of his nose and pretend it was his face and wasn't really listening to the guy interviewing him, but he's smiling malevolently at his friends and, like, looking at him, you think, what a manipulative, empty rat. You know, I thought this guy is me. And then last night, it was actually our anniversary, so I took her to see a show about Billie Holiday. I just looked at these showbiz people who know nothing about Billie Holiday. Like, nothing. They, in a kind of intellectual creeps. And I suddenly have this feeling, like, I'm just sitting there crying through most of the show again. And suddenly I have this feeling that I'm just as creepy as they are. And my whole life has been a sham because I didn't have the guts to be Billie Holiday either. Like, I just feel I'm washed up and wiped out. Like, I have squandered my life.
God, Howard, how can you say something like that?
Well, okay, you know, I may be very emotional right now, but since I came back home, I've just been finding the world that we live in more and more upsetting. Like, people here seem very strange to me now. I find the people around me very strange.
I agree with you, but I'm always trying to figure out how to describe just in what way they're strange. Why would you say they're strange?
Well, all right. So last week, I went down to the public theater one afternoon. And when I walk in, I say hello to everybody because I know them all and they know me and always very friendly. So seven or eight people told me how wonderful I looked. And one person says, you know, a woman in the casting office, she says, "Oh, you look horrible. Is something wrong?" Now, so we start talking, and I start telling her things, and then she bursts into tears because an aunt of hers, she's 80, who she's super fond of, went to the hospital for cataract, and that was solved, but the nurse was so sloppy, they forgot to put the bed rails up, and the aunt fell out of bed, and now she's crippled. So we're talking about hospitals. This woman, because this has happened recently, and because who she is, she could see me with a complete clarity, and she didn't know anything about what I had been going through, but the other people, what they saw was this tan, or this shirt, or the fact that this shirt goes well with the tan, and they say, "You look wonderful," and they're in this insane dream world because they're not looking. That's very strange to me.
Right. They didn't see anything somehow except the few little things that they wanted to see.
Exactly. It's like what had happened just before my father died. Because we had gone to the hospital to see him, and I had been in to see him, and I saw this guy who looked as bad as like a war survivor, and I'm out in the hall sort of, you know, being there for my mom, and this doctor, who's a specialist in a problem that he had with his arm, goes into the room and comes out beaming and says, "Boy, don't we have a lot of reason to feel great? Isn't it wonderful how he's coming along?" And all I could see was the arm. And that's all he saw. And here's another person who's just existing in a dream, who on top of that is kind of a butcher, you know, committing this sort of familial murder, because he comes out of the room and he psychically kills us. He's taking us into a dream world where we become confused and frightened, because the moment before we saw somebody who looked already dead. Now here comes the specialist who tells us everything's great. Like, they're literally driving my family crazy, because here's an 82-year-old man, very emotional, who, you know, you go in one minute, you see that person's dying and you don't want them to die, and a doctor comes out and tells you they're in wonderful shape, like, you go crazy.
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like, the doctor didn't see my father. The people that at the theater, they didn't see me. We're all walking around in this kind of fog. Like, I remember when something like all those school kids in Belgium got kidnapped, or like the Munich massacre or the Guyana massacre would have absolutely stopped the world. Like, people would have stopped their work and listened to the radio, and that doesn't happen now. I don't know what's wrong. Like, maybe I just have this on my mind, but I think we're living in the middle of a plague. Like, a cancer today is a plague dimensions, which I find terrifying, because I'm terrified of cancer. And we know that people in their 20s and 30s are being hit by it.
Right.
And, like, since I've been back in New York, I've heard half a dozen cases. We hear about it all the time, but is anyone calling that a plague? Like, back in the time of the Black Plague, when that hit, people got the hell out. The whole English court left London. Anybody who could get on the road went, and people knew you should get out. And now, you know, say you believe what we're doing to the environment contributes to cancer. You know, chemicals we use and food we eat. Like, what are we doing about it? Are we doing anything? You know, when the plague hit, people put handkerchiefs over their noses. What are we doing? I think we're all in a trance. We're walking around like zombies, and like, I don't even think we're aware of ourselves or our reactions to things. It's like my Norwegian friend. Like, what would be the normal thing that we all do now would be that I had spent the evening with him, and then when she came back, I'd have said, "Oh, I had a nice, cozy evening. We had an interesting talk about Norway," and so on. And even though actually I was miserable and I found his company unbearable, you know, if you admit to yourself that you just spend an evening with someone for some reason or another on that particular evening, they were somehow driving you insane, then I think you should immediately feel some kind of sympathy for that person, and you begin to wonder how they come to be in the state they're in. But we don't admit those things. Like, we just bottle everything up, and we're going around like unconscious machines, and there's all this rage and worry and uneasiness just building and building up inside of us.
Yeah, that's right. They build up and then they leap out inappropriately. I mean, I remember when I was in this play based on The Master and the Margarita by Bulgakov, and I was playing the part of the cat, but they had trouble making up my cat suit. So, in fact, I didn't get it delivered to me until the night of the first performance, particularly the head. I had never even had a chance to try it on. And about four of my fellow actors actually came up to me and said things which I just couldn't help thinking were attempts to destroy me. You know, one of them said, "Oh, that head will totally change your hearing in the performance. You'll hear everything completely differently. It may be very upsetting." I was in a performance when I was wearing earmuffs and I couldn't hear anything anybody said. And then another actor said, oh, you know, whenever I even wear a hat on stage, I tend to faint. I mean, those remarks were just full of hostility because, you know, if I'd listened to those people, I would have gone out there on stage and I wouldn't have been able to hear anything and I would have fainted. But the hostility was completely inappropriate because, in fact, those people liked me. I mean, the hostility was some feeling left over from some previous experience because somehow in our social existence, we're only allowed to express our feelings weirdly and indirectly. If you can express them directly, everyone goes crazy.
Now, did you express your feelings about what those people said to you?
No. I mean, I didn't really even know what I felt until I thought about it later. And even if I had known what I felt, I mean, at the most, in a situation like that, I might say something if I'm really annoyed, like, yes, well, that's just fascinating, and I probably will faint tonight, just as you did.
Yes, very Baroque. The person probably wouldn't actually know what the hell you were even saying to them. I do the same thing.
I mean, it's just not easy to do anything else. I mean, do you remember? I remember a party we both went to years ago, somewhere over on Park Avenue, in around the 90s, I think. And you were there, and Debbie and I were there. And just in that period after Nixon resigned, when for some reason nobody talked about anything political for any reason, I mean, it was just taboo. Yeah. It was just not done. And at one point during the evening, you started talking about something having to do with the politics of the moment, the international situation. I don't remember exactly what it was. And you became quite serious and you were all of a sudden saying just a few things that were quite impassioned and that you really meant. And everybody went practically insane.
Really?
Yeah, I remember it was as if six people just rushed up to stop you and to put you back in your cage or something. It was as if something uncanny had happened. You know, everyone started making jokes and acting as if, of course, you didn't mean it. And everyone was talking at once. And even in my own way, I was also pushed back because I said a couple of things.
Yep, I remember that. Yes, I remember.
And just as you got serious, suddenly everyone else was joking.
Well, I mean, okay, so I remember a night, and it was 2 weeks after my father died, and I was in pretty bad shape. So I went out to dinner with three close friends, two of whom had known my dad pretty well, and three of whom have known me for years. So we went to the entire evening without, you know, without getting near what. Not that I wanted to sit and have a dreary evening where you talk about all this pain that you're going through. Like, not that, but the fact that nobody could say, like, what a shame, or how are you feeling? It was as if nothing had happened. Everyone was just making jokes and laughing, and I went a little crazy, as a matter of fact, and one of the people mentioned a certain person I don't like very much, and I started screeching about how he'd just been found in the Bronx River, and his penis had dropped off from gonorrhea, and all kinds of other insane things, and, like, I realized when I got home, I had just been desperate to break through this ice. Like, yeah. You realize, Hollow, that if you brought that situation into a Tibetan home, it would just be, like, so far out right. That, like, they wouldn't be able to understand it.
Right.
Like, it would simply be so weird. If four Tibetans came together and tragedy struck one of them, and they spent all evening going, ha 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 ha, those Tibetans would have looked at that and they thought that's the most unimaginable behavior, but for us that's common. Like, Africans probably would have put their spears into all four of us because it would have driven them crazy. They would have thought we were dangerous or something like that because that's abnormal behavior. But these are typical evenings for us. We go to parties and dinners like that all the time. Evenings like this are a sort of sickly dream because people are talking in symbols. Everyone is floating through this fog of symbols and unconscious feelings, and no one says what they're really thinking about. They don't talk to each other because I think people are really in some sort of state of fear or panic about the world we're living in, but they don't know it. And so you just hear these odd lines of dialogue that seem to come from nowhere. Like, someone will be attacking some movie they saw or an article they read. Someone else will be talking about crime in New York or the subway or something. And someone else will be shouting about what a terrible time they're having at the party itself. And then people start making all these jokes that are really some kind of secret code and...
Right. Well, what often happens in some of these evenings is that people will start spinning these really crazy little fantasies and everyone will be talking at once and saying, you know, wouldn't it be great if Frank Sinatra and Mrs. Nixon and blah, blah, blah were in such and such a situation, you know, always with famous people and always sort of grotesque. Or people will be talking about some horrible thing like the death of the girl in the car with Ted Kennedy and just roaring with laughter. I mean, it's really amazing. It's unbelievable. I mean, that's the only way anything is expressed, through these completely insane jokes. That may be why I never understand what's going on at a party and I'm always completely confused. I mean, we'll come home and Debbie will describe some incredible incident and I won't have even noticed it. Everything passes in a kind of trance, you know. She once said after one of these New York evenings that she thought she'd traveled a greater distance just by journeying from her origins in the suburbs of Chicago to that New York evening than her grandmother had traveled in making her way from the steppes of Russia to the suburbs of Chicago.
Yeah, like... That's right. What we need is to analyze our situation in the world with greater clarity. So, because then we can act and respond appropriately. But instead, we get together and we fall into a kind of collective hysteria and nobody knows what's going on. And maybe one of the reasons that we don't know what's going on is that when we're at one of these parties, we're all too busy performing. Like, we're concentrating on playing our own role and giving a good performance that we can't perceive what's going on around us. Like, that was one of the reasons that Grotowski gave up the theater, because he felt that people in their lives were performing so well that performance in the theater was sort of superfluous, in a way almost obscene. Like, isn't it amazing how often a doctor will live up to our expectation of how a doctor should look? Like, when you see a terrorist on TV, he looks just like a terrorist. Like, we live in a world where fathers or single people or artists are all trying to live up to someone's fantasy of how a father or a single person or an artist should look and behave. And everyone acts as if they know how they ought to conduct themselves in every single moment, and they seem totally self-confident. And privately, people are very mixed up about themselves and they don't know what they should be doing in their lives. And they're reading all these self-help books.
Right. And I mean, these books are so touching because they show how desperately curious we are to know how all the others of us are really getting on in life, even though by performing these roles all the time, we're hiding the reality of ourselves from everyone else. You know, we do live in ludicrous ignorance of each other. I mean, we usually don't know the things we'd like to know, even about our supposedly closest friends. I mean, suppose you're going through some kind of hell in your own life. Well, you would love to know if your friends have experienced similar things, but we really don't dare ask each other.
Well, no, it would be like asking a friend to drop their role.
Right? We just put no value at all on perceiving reality. On the contrary, the incredible emphasis we place now on our so-called careers automatically makes perceiving reality a very low priority. Because if your life is organized around trying to be successful in a career, then it just doesn't matter what you perceive or what you experience. You're just thinking, well, have I done the thing that I've planned? Have I performed the necessary action for my career? And so you really can sort of shut your mind off for years ahead in a way. You can sort of turn on the automatic pilot just the way your father's doctor had on his automatic pilot when he went in and looked at the arm and totally failed to perceive anything else.
Yeah, like our minds are so focused on goals and plans, but they themselves are not reality.
No, goals and plans are not reality. They're fantasy. They're part of a dream life. And, you know, it always does seem so ridiculous somehow that everybody has to have his little goal in life. It's so absurd in a way. I mean, when you consider that it doesn't matter which one it is, I mean, I guess maybe it's satisfying to devote your life to trying to get money or trying to create great works of art. I don't know. But when they're so interchangeable, somehow it seems sort of pathetic.
Yeah, it does.
But we just seem to think today that the person who pursues his goals most single-mindedly and fanatically is the person most worthy of respect. I mean, I think maybe that's why actors are not given a great deal of respect. It's because actors spend most of their time actually playing, like children. I mean, each night when I was putting on my fake nose during the fourth act of The Mandrake, I would think about the fact that when I was growing up, this wasn't what people had in mind for me. But, I mean, there's always the excuse for an actor that, you know, you may be putting on a fake nose and running around acting like a jerk, but then after the performance, you can hang up your nose and you can put on a suit and tie. And, you know, in England, you can even be a lord and be a quite distinguished member of society. Or Charlton Heston, you know, can be a very important member of the National Endowment for the Arts and things like that. And you can really act like a businessman.
Yeah. So, like, the actor hangs up his nose and puts on a suit. I think businessmen sort of do the opposite. They take off their suits and put on a nose, you know. They need to play, too. So they go out drinking and carousing or whatever. And the man who becomes a businessman has a difficult life. He has to go to work every day. And for us, that's very exotic. He has to sit up in the penthouse of some skyscraper thinking seriously about stocks. And I think people like us are what Jung would call his shadow side. Like, we are who part of him would like to be, just as part of us would like to be having a lot of those business lunches and making that money and wheeling and dealing and so on.
You're right, but playing takes people away from this focus on their goals, so it's considered contemptible.
Yeah, and then because people's concentration is on their goals, in their life they just live each moment by habit. Like the Norwegian guy telling the same stories over and over. Life becomes habitual, and it is, you know. Like, very few things happen. Like when Marlon Brando sent that woman to accept his Oscar and everything went haywire.
Right.
Like, things rarely go haywire now.
Right.
And if you're operating by habit, then you're not really living. Like, do you know, in Sanskrit, the root of the verb to be is the same as to grow or to make grow.
Okay.
Do you know about Rock?
About what?
Rock of Findhorn?
No.
Rock was a wonderful man. He was one of the founders of Findhorn. And he was Scotland's greatest mathematician and one of the century's greatest mathematicians. And he prided himself on the fact he had no dream life, no fantasy life, nothing to stand between, no imagination, just nothing between him and the direct perception of mathematics. And when he was in his mid-50s, he was walking in the gardens of Edinburgh and he saw a faun. And the faun was surprised because fauns have always been able to see people, but very few people ever see that. You know, little imaginary creatures, not a deer. You know, you call them fauns, don't you?
I thought a fawn was a baby deer.
Yeah, but there's the deer called a fawn, but there's, you know, like the little...
The kind of that... Debussy?
Yeah, okay. Anyway, he got to know the fawn, and then he got to know these other fawns, and a series of conversations began, and more fawns would come out every afternoon and meet with him, and he'd have talks with the fawns, and one day after a while, you know, they really got to know him. They asked him if he wanted to meet Pan, because Pan wanted to meet him. And of course, Pan was afraid of terrifying him, because he knew the Christian misconception portrayed Pan as an evil creature, but he's not. So Rock said he would love to meet Pan, and they met. Pan indirectly sent him on his way on a journey in which he meet the other people who began Findhorn. But because Rock used to practice certain exercises, like if he were right-handed all today, he would do everything with his left hand all day, writing, eating, everything, opening doors in order to break the habits of living, because the great danger for him was to fall into a trance out of habit. So he had this whole series of exercises, very simple ones, but he invented them just to keep seeing, feeling, remembering. Because you see, you have to learn now. It didn't used to be necessary, but today you have to learn something like that. Are you really hungry, or are you stuffing your face because that's what you do out of habit? I mean, you can afford to do it, so you do it whether you're hungry or not. Now, if you go to the Buddhist meditation center, they make you taste each bite of your food, so it takes about 2 hours. It's horrible eating your lunch there, but you're conscious of the taste of food. And if you're just eating out of habit, you don't taste the food. And if you're not in touch with the reality of what's happening to you, you're in the dream world again.
Right. Well, do you think maybe we're living in this dream world because we do so many things every day that somehow affect us in ways we're not aware of? I mean, I was thinking, for example, last Christmas I was given an electric blanket, and I can tell you that it's such a marvelous advance over our former way of life that it's great. And it's quite different from not having an electric blanket. And I sometimes sort of wonder, well, what is it doing to me? I mean, I sort of feel I'm not sleeping in the same way.
Well, you wouldn't be.
I mean, and my dreams are sort of different, and I feel a little bit different when I get up in the morning.
Yeah, 'cause I wouldn't put an electric blanket on it for anything, because I'd be worried that I might get electrocuted, because I don't really trust technology. But the main thing, it's that kind of comfort separates you from reality in a very direct way.
You mean,
Like, if you don't have the electric blanket and your apartment's cold, then you need to put on another blanket or go to the closet and pile up coats on top of the blankets you have. And well, then, I mean, you know it's cold. But that sets up a link of things. Like, you have compassion for the person. Is the person next to you cold? Are there other people in the world who are cold? What a cold night. I like the cold. I don't really want a blanket. It's fun being cold. Snuggle up against you even more because it's cold and all sorts of things occur to you. Like, but turn on the electric blanket. It's like taking a tranquilizer or being lobotomized watching television. I think you enter this dream world again because what does it do to us? Hollow, living in an environment where something as massive as seasons and cold and winter don't affect us because we're animals. And what does that mean? That means instead of living under the sun and the moon and the sky and the stars, we're living in a fantasy world of our own making.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, I would never give up my electric blanket, Howard, because New York is cold and our apartment is cold in the winter. It's a difficult environment. Our lives are tough enough as it is. I mean, I'm not trying to get rid of the few things that provide relief and comfort. On the contrary, I'm looking for more comfort because the world is very abrasive. And I mean, I'm trying to protect myself because really, there are these abrasive beatings to be avoided everywhere you look.
But don't you see that that kind of comfort can be dangerous? Like, you like to be comfortable. I like to be comfortable too. But don't you see that it can lull you into a dangerous tranquility? Like, my mom knew a woman, Lady Hatfield, who was one of the richest women in the world, but she died of starvation because all she would eat was chicken. I mean, she just liked chicken. And that was all she would eat, and her body was starving, but she didn't know because she was happy eating chicken. And then finally she died. And I honestly believe we're all like Lady Hatfield now. We're having lovely, comfortable time with electric blankets and our chicken. And meanwhile, we're starving because we're so cut off from contact with reality that we're not getting sustenance because we don't see the world. We don't see ourselves. We don't see how our actions affect other people. Kozan would get terribly upset if I was 15 minutes late for an appointment, he'd say, "You made a promise. You've broken your promise." Because we don't take commitments seriously. We don't think about what we're saying or doing. And there was this thing that happened when I was visiting Warsaw last year, because I've been back a few times since the time I told you about, but I was attending this conference run by the ITI, International Theater Institute. And at one point, I decided I wanted to go out and join this group I heard about who worked in the country in villages that haven't changed since the time of the Hundred Years' War.
Right.
Now, at that point, the ITI conference is over, but I happen to be at the office, and there's a young man who was just locking up. He's like 25 or something like that, 26. I grab this guy and I say, "Listen, I never met him or anything, but he knew me because I had been in and out of the office, and his work was over, so he had nothing to gain." And I said, "Listen, you know, I'm going to go work with this group, and I'll need a sleeping bag, and I didn't bring one to Poland, so you don't know where I could borrow one, do you?" He said, "You can borrow mine. That's no problem." And he said, "Meet me in the bar tonight at 11. I'll bring it to you." Wonderful. So I go to the bar. He didn't show up. Midnight comes, 1 o'clock. You know, I figure, it didn't mean anything to him, and he had forgotten about it. So the next day, I got on the train and went on what was a four-hour journey by train, and then an hour and a half journey by bus, and then an hour on foot. And this is really far away. And 4 or 5 laters after I arrived, he arrived with the sleeping bag.
No.
And yeah, he hadn't been able to keep the appointment because his mother hadn't been well. He had tried to get a hold of me. And he had made a promise that he'd hitchhiked all the way just to get me the sleeping bag.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that could happen with people here. I'm not sure why, but I can't picture it.
I know. I agree with you. Somehow we're just not, I mean, I don't know why this occurs to me, but it somehow reminds me of when I was acting in The Master and Margarita at the Public Theater. The role of the devil was played by a wonderful Czech actor named Jan Triska. And I was always incredibly struck by the way that he would say good evening to each of his fellow actors, you know, as he would be arriving for the evening's performance and starting to get dressed. I mean, it was the way he would greet us. It was just so respectful somehow. It was as if we were all dignified members of some very highly disciplined and honorable organization. I don't know how to describe it, but he seemed to take us all so seriously. And it was as if putting on this performance really was something that mattered, something special, something with some kind of sacred quality.
That's like the Hasidic thing, you know, the idea of making every moment a sacrament, like a gift or an act of veneration. Have you ever read Martin Buber's On Hasidism?
No.
Okay, so here's a view of life. He talks about the belief of Hasidic tribes and that there are spirits chained in everything. There's spirits chained in you, they're chained in me, there's spirits chained in this table right here. That prayer is the action of liberating these enchained embryo-like spirits, and that every action of ours in life, whether it's business or making love or having dinner or whatever, that every action should be a prayer, a sacrament in the world. Now, do you think we're living like that?
No.
So why do you think we're not living like that? I think it's because if we allowed ourselves to see what we're doing every day, we might just find it nauseating, the way we treat other people. You know, every day, several times a day, I walk into my apartment and the doorman calls me Mr. Vander and I call him Jimmy. And the same transaction probably occurs between you and the guy you buy groceries from every day in some other way.
Uh-huh.
So what is the difference between that and plantation owners and slaves? Because I think an act of murder is committed in the moment when I walk into my building. Because here's a dignified, intelligent man around my own age. And when I call him Jimmy, he becomes a child and I'm an adult. Because I can buy my way into that building. And I remember an elevator man who every single night used to give me the weather report, like, that's all he could talk about. And no matter what you said to him, he gave you the weather report. I think that man had been murdered inside the elevator by people like me.
Right. That's, I mean, my God, when I was a Latin teacher, people used to treat me, I mean, if I would go to a party of professional or literary people, I mean, I was just treated in the nicest sense of the word, like a dog. In other words, there was no question of my being able to participate on an equal basis in the conversation with people. I mean, I would occasionally have conversations with people, but then when they asked what I did, which would always happen after about 5 minutes, their faces, even if they were enjoying the conversation or they were flirting with me or whatever it was, their faces would just, have that expression like the portcullis crashing down and, those medieval gaze. And they would just walk away. I mean, I literally lived like a dog. I mean, I would be at a party where there would be all these great personalities, and the idea that I could participate in things in any way, except to sort of pad through on all fours and sort of lick people's trousers, was just inconceivable.
Oh, that's right.
I mean, when my wife was working as a secretary, if she would tell people what she did, they would just go insane. I mean, they just wouldn't be able to handle it. It would be as if she'd said, well, I'm serving a life sentence for child murdering. And I mean, when you talk about our attitudes towards people, I mean, I think of myself as a very decent, good person simply because I think I'm reasonably friendly to most of the people I happen to meet every day. I mean, I really think of myself quite smugly, and I think I'm a perfectly nice guy, so long as I somehow think of the world as consisting of, just the small circle of people I know as friends, or the few people that we know in this little world of our hobbies, the theater or whatever it is, and I'm really quite self-satisfied. I'm happy with myself. I have no complaint about myself. I mean, if I'm just one more nice student in the Dalton School in the 7th grade, well then, I'm just as nice as the next guy in the 7th grade. But the thing is, let's face it, there's a whole enormous world out there that I don't ever even think about. And I certainly don't take responsibility for how I've lived in that world. I mean, if I were actually to confront the fact that I'm sort of sharing this stage with the starving person in Africa somewhere, well, then I wouldn't feel so great about myself. So naturally, I blot those people out of my perception. So, of course, I'm ignoring a whole section of the real world. Hannah Arendt was always writing about the fact that the more involved you are in corruption or evil, and the more areas of your own existence there are that you therefore don't want to think about, or that you can't face, or that you have to lie about, the more distorted your perception of reality will be in general. In other words, we all have every reason to hide from reality, and it's a terrible problem. But I mean, frankly, when I write a play, in a way, one of the things I guess I'm trying to do is precisely bring myself up against some little bits of reality, and I'm trying to share that with an audience. I mean, the theater, I mean, of course, we all know that the theater is in terrible shape today. I mean, at least a few years ago, people who really cared about the theater used to say, theater is dead. But now everyone has redefined the theater in such a trivial way. I mean, I know people who are involved with the theater who go to see things now that, I mean, a few years ago, these same people would have been just embarrassed to have even seen some of these plays. I mean, they would have just shrunk, just in horror at the superficiality of these things. But now they say, oh, that was pretty good. It's just incredible. And I find that attitude unbearable because I actually do believe that the theater can be very important. It can actually help people come in contact with reality. Now, you may not feel that at all. You may find that absurd.
Well, don't you see the dilemma though? Because you're not taking into account the period that we live in. Because of course that's what theater should do. I've always felt that. Like when I was young, I directed the Bakke at Yale. It was my impulse. When Pentheus gets killed by his mother in the Furies, and they pull the tree back and they tie him to the tree and fling him into the air, he flies through space. He's killed. They rip him to shreds, like cut off his head. My impulse was that the thing to do was get a head from the New Haven morgue and pass it around the audience. Like I wanted them to bring out a real head. And that the head should be passed around so that the audience could realize that this stuff was real, that it's real stuff. But the actress playing Agawe absolutely refused to do it. And I wouldn't do it myself today, but that was my impulse at the time. So I think it would have been wonderful if the perceptions of the audience could be brought to life, if the senses of the audience could be brought to life. You know, Gordon Craig used to talk about why there's gold and silver in the churches, you know, the great cathedrals, when actors could be wearing gold and silver. And people who saw like Eleanor Duse the last couple of years of her life, people said it was like seeing light on stage or mist or like the essence of something. People don't talk about it as a performance or acting. They said it was like the backgrounds of Da Vinci paintings, you know. And when you think of Bertolt Brecht, like he did something that was maybe the most amazing thing of all, because he somehow created a theater where people could observe, and that was vastly entertaining and exciting, but in which the excitement didn't overwhelm you. Like he managed to allow you the distance between the play and yourself in the fact that you didn't need two human beings in order to live together. Like people say that he was against feeling, but that's not true. I think he was looking for a kind of clarity in theater that would permit real feeling. And I think what he was against was that kind of fevered intensity or emotion that erupts when real feeling is suppressed. But Hollow, the question is whether the theater now can do for an audience what Brecht tried to do or what Craig or Deuce used to do. Can it do it now? Because I think people are so deeply asleep that unless you're putting on these sort of superficial plays that help your audience sleep more comfortably, like I think it's very hard to know what to do in theater. Like, what if the people in the audience aren't just asleep? What if they're dead? You know, so that nothing you can do will wake them up. Like last season that my company performed in New York, I remember thinking something was wrong. Like, you know, there we were, and the actors are doing excellent work, and all of a sudden it began to feel like we were performing in an opera house, and every member of the audience was sitting in the back row, and I just began to feel like there was nothing we could do to reach them.
So you were trying to bring the patient back to life.
Yeah.
And you performed Chekhov in front of the patient and it didn't work.
Well, exactly.
So you just did every play you could think of, and then finally you just picked that person up and put him over your back and carried him off to the Himalayas and put him on Mount Everest just to see if that would do it.
Well, that's right. You know, he had to go to Mount Everest. It was another form of theater because, you know, when we were lying in those graves, a part of us believed we were really being buried alive. And a part of us knew that we weren't, just the way that, like in the theater, a part of you believes people are really being murdered on stage, yet you know that they're not. It was theater because we were consciously creating an intense, imaginative experience for one another. We weren't really burying each other alive, but we were playing. And in things like that beehive, we might have had impulses to kill each other or to make love, just as actors do in rehearsal, but we didn't because it wasn't life. It was theater. But it wasn't the kind of theater where an audience passively watches a play. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with plays. Plays are great. But what kind of plays are appropriate today? It's confusing because I think if you put on serious contemporary plays by writers like yourself, you may only be helping to deaden the audience in a different way. Like, there was a time where contemporary plays of a certain kind could have had a prophetic function or would have been warnings to people, but there's been such a degeneration and the world is so dark and cold that even works that were once outcries against the darkness, they can only contribute to the deadening process.
What do you mean?
Well, How do you think it affects an audience to put on one of these plays where you show that people are totally isolated now? They can't reach each other and their lives are obscene and driven and desperate. How does it affect them to see a play that shows our world is full of nothing but shocking sexual events and violence and terror? Does that help wake up a sleeping audience? I don't think so, because it's very likely that the picture of the world you're showing them in a play is exactly like the picture of the world they have already. And they know their own lives and relationships are painful and difficult. And if they watch the evening news, well, all they see is a terrifying, chaotic universe full of rape and murder and hands cut off by subway cars and kids pushing their parents out of windows. So the play just tells them that their impression of the world is correct and there's no way out. There's nothing they can do, so they end up feeling passive and impotent. And the experience has helped to deaden them. They're more asleep than when they went into the theater. And I love the theater. I want to direct plays again, but it's difficult because the things I'd like to do in the theater, like, look at something like that christening my group arranged in Poland. There was an example of people creating something that really had all the elements of theater. It was worked on carefully. It was thought about carefully. It was done with exquisite taste and magic. And they, in fact, created something, which in this case was a way just for the audience of one, just for me. They created something that had ritual, love, surprise, denouement, beginning, middle, and end. And it had a real moon instead of a painted one, and a real castle instead of a painted one. And it was still an incredibly beautiful piece of theater. And the impact it had on its audience, on me, was a total positive. It didn't deaden me. It brought me to life.
But, Howard, are you saying that it's impossible? I mean, really, I mean, isn't it a little upsetting to come to the conclusion that there's no way to wake people up anymore except to involve them in some kind of christening in Poland or some kind of strange experience on top of Mount Everest? Because, I mean, the awful thing is, let's face it, Howard. I mean, if you say that it really is necessary to take everybody to Everest, then it's really tough because everybody can't be taken to Everest. I mean, there must have been periods in history when you would have been able to save the patient through less drastic measures. I mean, there must have been periods when, in order to give people a strong or meaningful experience, you wouldn't actually have to take them to Everest.
But you do now. In some way or another, you do now.
I mean, there was a time when you could have just, for instance, written, I don't know, Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen, and I'm sure that the people who read it had a pretty strong experience. I'm sure they did. All right, now you're saying that people today wouldn't get it. And maybe that's true, but I mean, isn't there any kind of writing or any kind of play that, I mean, isn't it legitimate for writers still to try to portray reality so that people can see it? I mean, of course the things you did in those workshops had a powerful impact on you. I mean, you know, they weren't really aesthetic experiences, they were just experiences in your life. I mean, if you find yourself buried in a grave, obviously it affects you. I mean, the whole thing about those workshops was that you obviously weren't allowed to have any sort of ordinary daily experiences. You know, you say that people followed their impulses, but I'm sure it would have been sort of frowned on if somebody had just stood up one day and started saying, well, my career is going great. I've really had a great year. I'm making more money than you are. Or something like that. And I'm sure it would have been frowned on if somebody had just gone to the library in Warsaw and taken out a book and brought it into the room and started to read it. But I mean, the main thing, Howard, is why do we require a trip to Mount Everest in order to be able to perceive one moment of reality? Is Mount Everest more real than New York? Isn't New York real? I mean, I think if you could become fully aware of what existed in the cigar store next door to this restaurant, it would blow your brains out. I mean, isn't there just as much reality to be perceived in a cigar store as there is on Mount Everest? Like, what do you think? I mean, I think that not only is there nothing more real about Mount Everest, I think there's nothing that different in a certain way. I mean, reality is sort of uniform, so that if your perceptions are... I mean, if your own mechanism is operating correctly, it would become irrelevant to go to Mount Everest and sort of absurd because, Of course, on some level, obviously, it's very different from a cigar store on 7th Avenue, but I mean.
Well, I agree with you, but the problem is that people can't see the cigar store now. Like, things don't affect people the way that they used to. It may very well be that in another 10 years, people pay $10,000 cash to be castrating just in order to be affected by.
Well, why do you think that is? Why is that? Is it just because people are lazy today or they're bored? You know, when children are poor and they live in the country and have just a few little things to play with, then they're very, very thrilled by those few little things. But
Something.
if they're rich and live in the city and have a thousand things to play with, then they always seem to be bored and it's impossible to find anything to interest them.
Well, the word spoiled isn't a chance word, it's a strong word to be
Yeah.
spoiled.
Right. In other words, they're lost in that sense. I mean, spoiled means, a piece of meat that's been spoiled can't be unspoiled. It's doomed.
Right.
So, I mean, is that our problem? Is that what you're saying? Are we just like bored, spoiled children who've been lying in the bathtub all day playing with their plastic duck and now they're thinking, what can I do?
We're bored now. We're all bored. But has it ever occurred to you, Hala, that the process that creates boredom that we see in the world may be a self-perpetuating unconscious form of brainwashing created by totalitarian governments based on money? Like, all of this, what if all of this is more dangerous than one thinks? And what if it's not a question of individual survival, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and someone who is asleep will not say no. Like, I keep meeting people. Like, I was talking a few days ago to a guy I admire. He's a Swedish physicist, Gustav Bjornstrand. And he told me he no longer watches TV. He doesn't read the paper. He doesn't read magazines. He's cut them out of his life because he really does feel like we're in some Orwellian nightmare and that everything you hear contributes to turning you into a robot. And there's no doubt about it. We are becoming robots. Everyone outside can see this. I had to dinner with two European friends of mine the other night. They used to love New York, and they said everyone's turned into robots here. Everybody. The food was robot food. You said something to people and you didn't get a response. They said New York had become like a morgue. And when I was at Findhorn, I met this English tree expert who devoted his life to saving trees. And he got back from Washington lobbying to save redwoods. And he was 84, and he always travels with a backpack because he never knows where he's going to be tomorrow. And I met him at Findhorn, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "New York." He said, "That's an interesting place. Do you know a lot of New Yorkers who keep talking about the fact that they want to leave but never do?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Why do you think they won't leave?" And I gave him some banal theories, and he said, "I don't think it's that way. I think New York is the new model for the new concentration camp, where the camp is built by the inmates themselves. And the inmates are the guards, and they have the pride in this thing that they've built. They built their own prison, and they exist in a state of schizophrenia where they are both guards and prisoners. As a result, they, having been lobotomized, they've lost the capacity to leave the prison that they've made or even to see it as a prison." And then he went into his pocket, he took out a seed for a tree and says, "This is a pine tree." And he put it in my hand and said, "Escape before it's too late." And
Okay.
for 2 or 3 years now, she and I have had this unpleasant feeling that we really should get out. We're feeling like people in war zones in the 30s, get out of here, because the problem is where to go. It seems obvious the whole world is going in the same direction. Like, it seems quite possible that the 60s represented the last burst of the human being before it was extinguished. And this is the beginning of the rest of the future now. And that from here on, we'll just be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing. And there will be nobody left to remind them that there was a species called a human being with feelings and thoughts. And like, history and memory are right now being erased, and no one is going to remember that life existed on the planet. So Gustav Bjornstrand feels that there really is almost no hope, and we'll be going back to like a savage, lawless period. But the Findhorn people see it differently. They also feel that the world is getting darker and colder, but they believe that it's a law of nature because everything is balanced. As one thing gets darker and colder, something else gets lighter and warmer. And it's their feeling that there will be pockets of light opening up in different parts of the world, and that these will be, in a way, invisible planets on this planet. And that as we or the world grow colder, we'll be able to take invisible space journeys to these different planets, refuel for what it is we have to do, and then come back. Because, you see, they believe that there have to be centers now where people can come and reconstruct a new future for the world. And I was talking to Gustav. He was saying that these centers are growing up everywhere, and that what they're trying to do, which is also what Findhorn was trying to do, in a way what I was trying to do, these things can't be given a name. But in a way, all our attempts at creating a new kind of school or a new kind of monastery, and Bjornstrand talks about the concept of it, he calls it reserves. Islands of safety where history can be remembered and the human being can continue to be in order to maintain the species through a dark age. Like, in other words, we're talking about an underground, like, which did exist in the Dark Ages in a different way among mystical orders. And the purpose of the underground is to find out how to preserve the light, life, and culture. Like, how to keep things living. I keep thinking that we need a new language, like a language of the heart, as in the Polish forest, where language isn't needed, where language between people is a new kind of poetry, like the poetry of the dancing bee that tells us where honey is. I think in order to create that language, we're going to have to learn how you can go through a looking glass into a different kind of perception. And when you have that sense of being united into all things, suddenly you understand everything. There's this incredible building that they built at Findhorn, and they wanted to build a building that would seat 400 or 500 people. And the man who designed it never designed anything in his life. He wrote children's books. People wanted it to be a sort of hall of meditation, and people wanted it to be a lecture hall. But the psychic part of the community wanted to serve another function too, because they wanted it to be a kind of spaceship. At night, it could rise up and let the UFOs know it's a safe place and they would find friends here. But the problem was, because it needed a massive roof, was how to have a roof that would stay on top of the building and yet be able to fly up at night to meet flying saucers. So the architect meditated and came up with the simple solution of not joining the roof to the building, because that if it should fall off, because they have great gales up in northern Scotland, to keep it from falling off, he would get beach stones like this big. And, you know, because I worked on it too, just all up and down the roof like that, touching. Like, the idea was the energy would go from stone to stone and be so strong it would keep the roof down under any conditions. But at the same time, if it needed to go up, it would be light enough to go up. Whether it works. Architects don't know why it works. And it shouldn't work, because it should fall off. But it works. The gales blow and the roof should fall off, but it doesn't fall off.
Yeah, well, yeah. You see, well, Howard, you know, if you want to know my actual response to all this,
yes.
You want to hear my actual response?
Yes, well, I do.
Well, Howard, I mean my actual response. I mean, really, I'm just trying to survive, you know? I mean, I'm trying to earn a living. I'm trying to pay my rent and my bills. I mean, I live my life. I enjoy staying home. I'm reading Charlton Heston's autobiography, and that's that. I mean, occasionally, maybe I'll step outside and go to a party or something, and if I can occasionally get my little talent together and write a play, well, then that's wonderful, and I enjoy reading about other little plays that people have written and reading the reviews of those plays and what people have said about them and what people said about what people said. And I mean, I have a list of errands and responsibilities that I keep in a notebook, and I enjoy going through my list and carrying out the responsibilities and doing the errands and then crossing them off. I mean, I just don't know how anybody could enjoy anything more than I enjoy reading Charlton Heston's autobiography and, you know, getting up in the morning and having the cup of cold coffee that's been waiting for me all night, still there for me to drink in the morning. and no cockroach or fly has died in it overnight. I'm just so thrilled when I get up and I see that coffee there just the way I want it. I just can't imagine enjoying something else any more than that. I mean, obviously, if the cockroach, if there is a dead cockroach in it, then I have a feeling of disappointment and I'm sad. But I mean, I don't think I feel the need for anything more than all this. Whereas you seem to be saying that it's inconceivable that anyone could be having a meaningful life today and everyone is totally destroyed and we need to live in these outposts. I mean, even for you, I just can't believe. I mean, don't you find, isn't it pleasant to just get up in the morning? The Times is delivered, you can read it, and maybe you'll direct a play, maybe you won't direct a play, but forget about the play that you may or may not direct. Why is it necessary to, why not lean back and just enjoy these details? I mean, there would be a delicious cup of coffee and a piece of coffee cake. I mean, why is it necessary to have more than this or to even think about having more than this? I mean, I don't really know what you're talking about. I mean, I know what you're talking about, but I don't really know what you're talking about. And I mean, actually, even if I did feel the way you do, you know, that there's no possibility for happiness now, then frankly, I still couldn't accept the idea that the way to make life wonderful would be to totally reject Western civilization and to fall back into kind of belief in some kind of weird something. I mean, I don't even know how to begin talking about this, but I mean, you know, in the Middle Ages, before the arrival of scientific thinking as we know it today, well, people could believe anything. Anything could be true. A statue of the Virgin Mary could speak or bleed or whatever. But the wonderful thing that happened was that then, in the development of science in the Western world, certain things did come slowly to be known and understood. I mean, of course, all ideas in science are constantly being revised. I mean, that's the whole point. But we do at least know that the universe has some shape and order and that, you know, trees do not turn people or goddesses, and there are very good reasons why they don't. And you can't just believe absolutely anything. And I mean, the things you're talking about, I mean, either the stones have the weight to hold down the roof or they don't. And I mean, when you talk about things like that flag or the handprints, I mean, you seem constantly to be finding a significance in these things that to me are just facts. I mean, you found the handprints in the book and they were three Andres and one Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And to me, that is a coincidence. And the people who put that book together had their own reasons for putting it together. But to you, it was significant, as if that book had been written 40 years ago so that you would see it, as if it was planned for you in a way. I mean, really, I mean, Howard, let's say if I get a fortune cookie in a Chinese restaurant, I mean, of course, even I have a tendency. I mean, you know, I would hardly throw it out. I mean, I read it and I just sort of instinctively, it says something like a conversation with a dark haired man will be very important for you. I mean, I just instinctively think, well, who do I know who has dark hair? And did we have a conversation? And what did we talk about? In other words, I mean, I do tend to read it, but it's a joke in my mind. I mean, in other words, there's something in me that makes me read it, and I instinctively interpret it as if it really were an omen of the future. But in my conscious opinion, which is so fundamental to my whole view of life, I mean, I would have to change totally, I think, to not have this opinion. In my conscious opinion, this is simply something that was written in the cookie factory several years ago and in no way refers to me. I mean, the fact that I got it, the man who wrote it, he didn't know anything about me. He couldn't have known anything about me. There's no way that this cookie could actually have anything to do with me. And the fact that I've gotten it is basically a joke. And I mean, if I were planning to go on a trip on an airplane and I got a fortune cookie that said, don't go, I mean, I admit I might feel a bit nervous for about 1 second, but in fact, I would go because, I mean, that trip is going to be successful or unsuccessful based on the state of the airplane and the state of the pilot. And the cookie is in no position to know about that. And it's the same with any kind of prophecy or sign or omen, because if you believe in omens, then that means that the universe, I can hardly even begin to describe this, that somehow the future can send messages backwards to the present, which means that the future exists in some sense already in order to be able to send these messages. And it also means that things in the universe are there for a purpose to give us messages. Whereas I believe that things in the universe are just there. They don't mean anything. I mean, if the turtle's egg falls out of the tree and splashes on the paving stones, it's just because that turtle was clumsy by accident. And to decide whether to send my ships off to war on the basis of that seems like a big mistake to me.
Well, what information would you send ships to war on? Because if it's all meaningless, then what's the difference whether you accept the fortune cookie or the statistics of the Ford Foundation? It doesn't seem to matter.
Well, the meaningless fact of the fortune cookie or the turtle's egg can't possibly have any relevance to the subject you're analyzing, whereas a group of meaningless facts, which are collected and interpreted in a scientific way, may quite possibly be relevant, because the great thing about scientific theories about things is that they're based on experiments that can be repeated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, if you're sending your ships to war, and you don't believe the current scientific opinions about the tides of the ocean, and you can repeat the experiments that everyone has done and see if you can come up with different results. Or you can try to show that those experiments are not the ones which should have been conducted in the first place.
Well, the truth is, Hollow, in retrospect, the things I was involved in are all, in a way, disgusting to me. Like, I look back on it, you know, the thought that I was playing with flags and so on, like, because I think what it means to be involved in those things in a way is that you've entered the unconscious and that you're in the world of the unconscious, like that to some extent your ego has gone or your ego base has dissolved and like you're in the underworld. Like you can actually begin to think you have the unconscious ability to make signs or omens happen, and you can get excited by it because you think you have some kind of power, and that's disturbing. You know, following omens and so on is just probably a way to let ourselves off the hook so we don't have to take responsibility for our actions, because it's not easy for us to make our own decisions. And because our knowledge of ourselves is too limited, our ability to take what we feel and develop that into concrete positive action for ourselves is limited. So rather than standing on our own feet and saying, this is what I believe and this is what I want, this is what I need, we pretend we're following omens and whatever. Like, I agree with you. It's frightening. I mean, giving yourself over to the unconscious can leave you vulnerable to a lot of frightening manipulation. All the work I was involved in, there was always that danger, and there's always been that question of tampering with people's lives. Because if I leave one of these workshops, I partly become a doctor and partly a therapist and partly a priest, and yet I'm not a doctor or a therapist or a priest. Already some of these monasteries, like we're talking about, become institutionalized and even in a way sort of fascistic. Like there's this self-satisfied elitist paranoia that grows up, like a feeling of them and us that can be very unsettling. And some of these people can build up a network of beliefs founded on science from anywhere that proves, like, without any question, they're right about everything. And, you know, you sit around and have dinner in some of these places, everyone's talking with great knowledge about Atlantis or whatever it is, and you feel very strange if you don't have all this secret info. And then they see all the significant coincidences in everything that happens, and that kind of self-contained, self-ratifying certainty can lead to terrible consequences, as we know. But the thing is, I think it's the exaggerated worship of science that's led us here. Like, science has been held up as a magical force that would solve everything. And quite the contrary. It's done quite the contrary. It's destroyed everything. So that really, what has led to the strong, deep reaction against science we're seeing now, just like in the 30s in Germany, it was a reaction against a certain oppressive kind of knowledge and culture.
Yeah, I know. That's all absolutely true. You know, the truth is, I think I do know what really disturbs me about the work that you've described, and I don't even know if I can really express it, Howard, but somehow, if I've understood what you've been saying, it somehow seems that the whole point of the work that you did in those workshops, when you get right down to it and ask what it really was about, the whole point, really, I think, was to enable the people in the workshops, including yourself, to somehow sort of strip away every scrap of purposefulness from certain selected moments. And the point of it was so that you would then be able to experience somehow just pure being. In other words, you were trying to discover what it would be like to live for certain moments without having any particular thing that you were supposed to be doing. I mean, that was the purpose of these workshops, really. And I think I just simply object to that. I mean, I just don't think I accept the idea that there should be moments in which you're not trying to do anything. I think it's our nature to do things. I think we should do things. I think purposefulness is a part of our ineradicable basic human structure. And to say that we ought to be able to live without it is like saying that a tree ought to be able to live without branches or roots. But actually, without branches or roots, it wouldn't be a tree. I mean, it would just be a log. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm sitting at home and I have nothing to do, well, I naturally reach for a book. I mean, what would be so great about just sitting there and doing nothing? It seems absurd.
And if Debbie's there?
Well, then that's the same thing. I mean, is there really such a thing as two people doing nothing but just simply being together? Would they simply then be relating, to use the word we're always using? What would that mean? I mean, either we're going to have a conversation, or we're going to carry out the garbage, or we're going to do something separately or together. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, what does it mean to just simply sit there?
That makes you nervous?
Well, why shouldn't it make me nervous? It just seems ridiculous to me.
Well, that's interesting, because when I went to Ladakh, which that's on the border of China and Tibet, I stayed on a farm for a month. And, you know, people come over in the evening for tea and nobody says anything, unless there's something to say, but there almost never is. So they sit there and they drink their tea and it doesn't seem to bother them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see, the trouble with always being active and doing things is that it's quite possible to do all sorts of things and at the same time be completely dead inside. I mean, you're doing all these things, but are you doing them because you really feel an impulse to do them? Or are you doing them mechanically, like we were saying before? Because I do believe that if you're living mechanically, you have to change your life. I mean, when you're young, you go on dates all the time and you go dance and you're floating free. And then one day you find yourself in a relationship and everything freezes. And this can be true in your work as well. As long as you're really alive inside, then of course it's no problem. But if you're living with someone in one little room and there's a life going on between you and the person you're living with, like, you know, a whole adventure can go on right in that room. But there's always that danger that things can go dead. And then I think you really do have to become a kind of hobo or, you know, like Kerouac and go out on the road. I really believe that. And it's not that wonderful to spend your life on the road. I mean, my own overwhelming preference is to stay in the room if you can. But if you live with somebody for a long time, people are constantly saying, well, of course, it's not as great as it used to be, but that's only natural. First blush of romance goes and, you know, that's just the way it has to be. Now, I disagree with that. Because I do think you have to constantly ask yourself the questions with a total frankness. Is your marriage still a marriage? Is the sacramental element there? Just same way you have to ask about the sacramental element of your work. Is it still there? And I mean, it's a very frightening thing to have to realize, like, oh God, I thought I was living my life. But in fact, I haven't been a human being. I've been a performer. I haven't been living. I've been acting. And I've acted the role of the father and the role of the husband and the friend and writer and director or whatever. I've lived in a room with the person, but I haven't really seen them. I haven't heard them. I haven't really been with them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Sometimes people are just existing side by side. I mean, the other person's face could just turn into a great wolf's face for seconds and it just wouldn't be noticed.
Well, it wouldn't be noticed. No, it wouldn't. Because when I was in Israel a little while ago, I have this picture of her that I always carry with. And it was taken when she was like 26. It's in summer. She's on a terrace in this old-fashioned skirt that's kind of pulled up and slam and sensual and beautiful. I've always looked at that picture and thought about how sexy she looks. And this year in Israel, I looked at the picture and realized the face in the picture was the saddest face in the world. That girl was so lost, just so alone. And I've been carrying this picture for years, not ever really seeing what it is. And I had never looked at the picture. And at a certain point, I realized that I had gone 18 years unable to feel, except in the most extreme situations. And I realized that, in fact, every day of one's life is made up of 1,000 constantly shifting feelings. And I knew this in theater. That was, you know, what my conception of a play was, but I didn't know it in my life. And I didn't really accept the fact that I'm a creature who wants to die of love for my daughter one moment, and the next moment I want to lock her in the cookie jar. I mean, to some extent, I still had the ability to live in my work, and that's why I was such a work junkie. That's why I felt like every play I did was a matter of life and death. But in real life, I was dead. I was a robot. And, you know, my life, my married life, has always been the most important thing in the world to me. But then it was frozen because I was afraid if I allowed myself to feel anything, I'd destroy it all. Like, at the time, I didn't allow myself to feel angry or annoyed. And today, you know, oh, they all did the things that annoy me or said things that annoy me. And today I got annoyed. And they said, why are you annoyed? And I said, because you're annoying, you know. When I allow myself to consider the possibility of not spending the rest of my life with her, I realized what I wanted most in life was to always be with her. But at the time, I hadn't learned what it would be like to let yourself react to another person, to follow your impulses with them from moment to moment along a chain that you can change from one second to the next. So if you can't react to another person, then there's no possibility of action or interaction. And if there isn't, then I don't really know what the word love means, except duty, obligation, sentiment, fear. Like, I don't know about you, but I just had to put myself into a kind of training program to learn how to be a human being. And what did I feel? I didn't know. What kind of things did I like? What kind of people did I want to be with? You know? And the only way I could think to find that out was just cut out the noise around me and stop performing for a few moments and just listen to what was inside. I think there comes a time where you need to do that. And maybe in order to do it, you have to go to the Sahara. And maybe you can do it at home, but you need to cut the noise.
Yeah, of course, personally, I don't usually like those quiet moments. You know, I really don't. I mean, I don't know if it's that Freudian thing or what. I mean, fear of unconscious impulses or my own aggression. Or, I mean, if things get too quiet, you know, as we were saying, I find myself just sitting there, whether I'm by myself or if I'm with somebody else. Well, I just have this feeling of, my God, I'm going to be revealed. I mean, I'm adequate to do any sort of task, you know, but I'm not adequate to just be a human being. I mean, I'm not, you know, if I'm just trapped there and I'm not allowed to do things, but I just, all I can do is just be there, I will fail. In other words, I can pass any other test and get an A if I put in the required effort, but I don't have a clue how to pass this test. Of course, It isn't really a test, but I see it as a test and I feel I'm going to fail it. I mean, it's really scary. I just feel totally at sea. I mean,
I can imagine a life where every day would become an incredible, monumental creative task. A life where everybody would just go with their impulses all day, and they would be themselves every moment with others, and we're not necessarily up to it. Like, if you felt like walking out on the person you live with, you'd walk out, and then if you felt like it, you would come back. But meanwhile, the other person would react to your walking out, and it would be a life of such feeling in a way. It would be intoxicating. I mean, what was amazing in the workshops that I led was how quickly people seemed to fall into enthusiasm and celebration, joy, wonder, abandon, wilderness, tenderness. And how could we stand to live like that? I mean, maybe we're afraid of living, or maybe what we're really afraid of is thinking about a kind of existence that we've lost, where if we would remember, it would make us give up everything.
I think it's that moment of contact with another person. That's what scares us, that moment of being face to face with another person. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be so frightening. It's strange that we find it so frightening.
Well, it isn't that strange, because, I mean, it really isn't that strange, because there are some good reasons for being frightened. First of all, a human being is a dangerous and complex creature. Like, if you start living each moment, Christ, quite a challenge, but if you really reach out and you're really in touch with the other person, and that's something to strive for. I think so. I really do.
It's just so pathetic if one doesn't do that.
Absolutely. It's nothing. I mean, at least attempt it, even if you can't make it. Attempt it, because even if you're going blind, do some exercises for your eyes or something, because, of course, there's a problem. The closer you come, I think, to another human being, the more really completely mysterious that person becomes, and the more unreachable. You have to reach out to that person, go back and forth with them, and you have to relate, and yet you're relating to a ghost or something, because we're ghosts, we're phantoms. Like, who are we? Right. And that's to confront the fact that you're completely alone, and to accept that you're alone is to accept death.
You mean because somehow when you are alone, you're alone with death. Nothing's obstructing your view of it or something like that.
Right.
So if I understood it correctly, I think Heidegger said that if you were to experience your own being to the full, you would be experiencing the decay of that being toward death as part of your experience.
Well, yeah, you know. In the sexual act, there's that moment of completely forgetting, which is so incredible. And then in the next moment, you start to think about things, work on your play, what you gotta do tomorrow. And I don't know if this is true for you, but I think it's common. The world comes at us quite fast. And that may be because we don't have the courage to stay in that place of forgetting, because that's, again, closer to death, like people who are afraid to go to sleep. In other words, you interrelate, and you don't know what the next moment will bring. And to not know what the next moment will bring brings you closer to a perception of death. So, paradoxically, the closer you get to living, in the sense of relating constantly, I guess the closer you get to this thing that we're the most afraid of.
Yeah.
I think that's why people have affairs. You know, in the theater, if you get good reviews, you feel for a moment that you got your hands on something. You know, it's a good feeling. But then that feeling goes away very quickly. And once again, you don't quite know what will happen next, what you should do. So you have an affair, and after a certain point, you can really feel you're on firm ground. There's a sexual conquest to be made. There's different questions. Does she enjoy her ears being nibbled? How intensely can you talk about Schopenhauer at an elegant restaurant, or whatever nonsense it is? It's all, I think, to give you the semblance that there's a firm earth. But have a real relationship with a person that goes on for years, and that's completely unpredictable. Because then you've cut off all your ties to the land, and you're sailing into the unknown, uncharted seas. And people hang on to these images of father, mother, husband, wife, again, for the same reason. Because they seem to provide some firm ground. But there's no wife there. What does that mean? A wife, a husband, a son, a baby holds your hands, and then suddenly there's this huge man lifting you off the ground. And then he's gone. Where's that son? You know?
Yeah. So, all the other customers seem to have left hours ago. We got the bill, and Howard paid for our dinner. I treated myself to a taxi. I rode home through the city streets. There wasn't a street, there wasn't a building, it wasn't connected to some memory in my mind. There I was, buying a suit with my father. There, I was having an ice cream soda after school. When I finally came in, Debbie was home from work, and I told her everything about my dinner with Vanderjam.